You're ready.
Ezekiel 17. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, put forth a riddle, and speak a parable unto the house of Israel, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, a great eagle with great wings, long-winged, full of feathers, which had diverse colors, came unto Lebanon, and took the highest branch of the cedar, cropped off the top of his young twigs, and carried it into a land traffic. He set it in a city of merchants. He took also of the seed of the land and planted it in a fruitful field. He placed it by great waters and set it as a willow tree. And it grew and became a spreading vine of low stature, whose branches turned toward him, and the roots thereof were under him. So it became a vine, and brought forth branches, and shot forth sprigs. There was also another great eagle, with great wings, and many feathers. And behold, this vine did bend her roots toward him, and shot forth her branches toward him, that he might water it by the furrows of her plantation. It was planted in a good soil by great waters, that it might bring forth branches, and that it might bear fruit, that it might be a goodly vine. Say thou, thus saith the Lord God, shall it prosper? Shall he not pull up the roots thereof, and cut off the fruit thereof, that it wither? It shall wither in all the leaves of her spring, even without great power, or many people, to pluck it up by the roots thereof. Yea, behold, being planted shall it prosper? Shall it not utterly wither when the east wind toucheth it? It shall wither in the furrows where it grew. End of verse 10.
You know, this is the passage in prophecy that the British Israel people try to claim that the king's daughters, who were with Jeremiah, had been brought to Britain and carried on the line of David in Britain. And while I don't have any problem seeing that the line of David was carried on somewhere, and especially the line of Judah Zarah, somewhere in Europe, I don't have a problem with that. And it's plausible because of the prophecies to David. But I don't see this passage as telling us that these king's daughters are going to be brought to England. I don't believe that this passage says that. I just believe that this passage is a prophecy of the kingdom of Judah and Jerusalem being planted somewhere else and becoming a vine of low stature, which is actually a humble vine, whose branches turn toward him, meaning Christ. That's how I read this.
Microphone activated.
Yeah, it's a very subjective view from their perspective to think that it's Britain.
Right. It has to be Britain and it has to be the king's daughters. I mean, the king's daughters went somewhere. They were with Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 43. But that doesn't, and they went into the land of Egypt with Jeremiah. But that's the last we hear of Jeremiah. And I haven't been convinced from old Irish literature. I've been looking for it. They quote these old Irish poems, but or they claim to be quoting old Irish poems, but they never make citations. What old Irish poems? Where do I find these books? How can I get them for myself and read them for myself? I've never seen that. Not that I'm an expert at Irish literature. I'm really not. And maybe I'm wanting in that area, but I would like that. I don't know if they're mentioned in the Four Masters, and I seriously doubt it. Maybe someday I'll check that out someday soon. The Four Masters being the Annals of Ireland.
Yeah, and also being humble. I mean, it's no offense to Brits, but they're not really known for being humble. They're actually known for being very self-righteous and for many centuries.
They were the most antagonistic nation in Europe throughout history. They were the most war-seeking nation throughout history.
Yeah.
Throughout European history, the last 1,000 years.
That would have been more the English than the Brits, though, right?
Well, yes. But how do you distinguish English from Brits?
Well, really Brits, Brits were like the Welsh, whereas the Angles were like the Normans that came in with William the Conqueror.
I understand that, but the Angles were the Germanic tribes that came in
in the sixth century
when the Brits were already there.
Yeah, you're right.
And the Normans, they really didn't come in very large numbers. They didn't supplant the Angles or the Brits. They only ruled over them for several generations. And even that wasn't for much longer than three generations, I think, or four. I don't really remember. I don't remember the details, but I know it wasn't very long until English kings began to rule again after the Normans.
In verse 4, he uses the word traffic. And then in the note, it says that it's Strong's H3667, which is Canaan.
Yes. Yes, and Canaan was used as a...
Metaphorically?
It was used metaphorically of traffickers or merchants. That is evident in other prophecies. I believe in Zechariah. I'm going to go. The common word for merchant is rakal.
Microphone muted.
Similar to Raka.
Zephaniah. How ye inhabitants of Maktesh, for all the merchant people are cut down. That word is Canaan. All the Canaanites are cut down. Hosea chapter 12, verse 7. He is a merchant. The balances of deceit are in his hand. He loves to oppress. That word is Canaan. So I would have to do a separate study to see if that really should be translated as merchant. It should probably be translated as
microphone Canaanite. Activated.
To be honest. But Jeremiah and the king's daughters didn't go to a city of Canaan. They went to Tapanhes in Egypt. Now, Tapanhes in Egypt really was a sort of a land of traffic. The city in archaeological surveys that have been and archaeological discoveries that have been made relatively recently, the site of ancient Tapanhes actually had a pretty large Greek presence in it. But I still don't think that that's going to compel me to describe this prophecy in that manner. I don't think that it's saying that at all. He took also of the seed of the land and planted it in a fruitful field. He placed it by great waters and set it as a willow tree. And it grew and became a spreading vine of low stature. That's talking about people in general. That's not talking about any specific people. Even a reference to the highest branch of the cedar doesn't really have to refer to the king's daughters.
J. just because the branch is plucked up, it seems like it might be describing a captivity, so I'm guessing that's where they got that idea.
Well, right, it's describing the captivity, but it's describing the captivity of Judah itself. As we saw in Jeremiah, I forget exactly where it is, but as we saw in Jeremiah, the 10,000 princes of Judah that were taken with Jehoiachin into captivity in Babylon, they were promised that they were going to prosper and do well. And the rest of the people in Jerusalem, they were promised that they were going to suffer and basically be cursed and have a absolutely contrary experience.
Yeah, well, I think when we continue, we'll see that that basically is the interpretation that's given.
I'm okay. Sure. I haven't had time to read ahead, but...
Moving on to 11.
Yes, it talks about the king's seed in chapter 13, in verse 13.
Okay, verse 11.
But in chapter 13, I'm sorry, in verse 13, where it speaks of the king's seed, that's not necessarily the daughters. That could very well refer to the 10,000 princes and the sons of Jehoiachin who were taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar, along with the prophet Ezekiel and the prophet Daniel when Zedekiah was made king by the Babylonians. Go on, Martin.
Verse 11. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, say now to the rebellious house, know ye not what these things mean? Tell them, behold, the king of Babylon is come to Jerusalem, and hath taken the king thereof, and the princes thereof, and led them with him to Babylon, and hath taken of the king's seed, and made a covenant with him, and hath taken an oath of him. He hath also taken the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be base, that it might not lift itself up, but that by keeping of his covenant it might stand. But he rebelled against him, in sending his ambassadors into Egypt, that they might give him horses and much people. Shall he prosper? Shall he escape that doeth such things? Or shall he break the covenant and be delivered? As I live, saith Yahweh, surely in the place where the king dwelleth, that made him king, whose oath he despised, and whose covenant he break, even with him in the midst of Babylon, he shall die. Neither shall Pharaoh with his mighty army and great company make for him in the war by casting up mounts and building forts to cut off many persons. Seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, when lo, he had given his hand and hath done all these things, he shall not escape. Therefore, saith Yahweh, as I live, surely mine oath shall he have, mine oath that he hath despised, and my covenant that he hath broken, even it will I recompense, upon his own head. And I will spread my net upon him, and he shall be taken into my snare, in my snare. And I will bring him to Babylon, and will plead with him there for his trespass, that he hath trespassed against me. And all his fugitives, with all his bands, shall fall by the sword. And they that remain shall be scattered toward all winds. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh, that I, Yahweh, have spoken it. Thus saith Yahweh, I will also take of the highest branch of the high cedar, and I will set it. I will crop off from the top of his young twigs a tender one, and will plant it upon a high mountain, an eminent. End of verse 22.
Okay.
Well, you know what? Actually, there's only two more verses.
Yeah.
Verse 23. In the mountain of the height of Israel will I plant it, and it shall bring forth boughs, and bear fruit, and be goodly, and be a goodly cedar, and under it shall dwell all fowl of every wing, and the shadow of the branches thereof shall they dwell. And all the trees of the field shall know that I, Yahweh, have brought down the high tree, have exalted the low tree, have dried up the green tree, and have made the dry tree to flourish. I, Yahweh, have spoken and have done it. End of chapter 17.
Okay. So this is a prophecy where in those earlier verses it says, taken of the king's seed and made a covenant with them and took them out of the land so that the kingdom might be based. That's what happened, evidently, when Nebuchadnezzar took those 10,000 princes, principal men of Jerusalem, into captivity in Babylon and put Zedekiah as king and instead of Jehoiachin. And what happened was the kingdom became base. Now, these words were spoken evidently from Ezekiel. In chapter 8, we read, in the sixth year, in the sixth month, and that's when all of these prophecies were given until the beginning of chapter 20, where we read, and it came to pass in the seventh year, in the fifth month. So chapter 20, verse 1, and it doesn't seem that the chapters are out of order at the beginning of Ezekiel, even though at the end, some of them certainly are. So if these chapters are not out of order, and there's no reason I could see to believe that they are, then this prophecy was given activated 6 years, 6.5 years after that captivity. Because Ezekiel's in that captivity, as we saw at the beginning of his writing, that he was at the river Kabar in Babylonia. That's where he began. So he was one of the people taken into that captivity. He said he was among the captives. So this is only 6 years after the captivity of Jehoiachin and the setting of Zedekiah as king. And Zedekiah has 5 years left to rule. He rules Jerusalem for 11 years before it's destroyed by the Babylonians and he's put to death. So he has 5 years left at this point. So this is referring back to that captivity in verses 11, 12, 13. And the sons of Jehoiachin went into captivity with him. The king's seed. They are the king's seed here, not the daughters of the king who were found later after Jerusalem's destroyed. It's Jeremiah. That's not the subject here. The sons of Jehoiachin are the subject here, who are in Babylonian captivity already and have been for over 6 years. That's the way I'm reading this. Has nothing to do with the king's daughters. Perhaps it does, but I can't say that it does, because it certainly doesn't seem to. An inheritance always goes through the father, through a male, not through a daughter, typically. So I don't believe the British Israel interpretation of this. I'm rejecting it. I would reject it. This is talking about the replanting of the kingdom, and perhaps it should be cross-referenced to where it says, I think it's in Amos, let me look at this, that the kingdom will come to the daughter of Jerusalem. That's in Micah chapter 4. The kingdom shall come to the daughter of Jerusalem, and that's where I would cross-reference this prophecy.
Where is the information that puts Jeremiah in Tophanas?
In Jeremiah?
Okay. All right.
Microphone activated.
Jeremiah chapter 6, 43 and 46. The king's daughters are with Jeremiah. King's daughters, Jeremiah chapter 43, verse 6. Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces took the remnant, all the remnant of Judah that were returned from all the nations whither they had been driven to dwell in the land of Judah, even men and women and children and the king's daughters, every person that the Nebuchadnezzar, but it says Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had left Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, and the son of Shaham, and Jeremiah the prophet, and Baruch the son of Neriah. So they came into the land of Egypt, for they obeyed not the voice of Yahweh. Thus they came even to Tophanas. Jeremiah 43, verses 5 to 7.
So there's also the Molossians, right? Who were, it said that they were from Melissa Spenya, whose grandmother or mother was Scota.
Well, you know what? That's British Israel. Less legends. I'm not sure where they get all that from, because the British Israel books I read when I was just starting this, that they weren't cited. They weren't well cited. Some of them weren't cited at all. There's a popular British Israel book called The Legend of Tia Tefi or something like that. The Book of Tefi. And they claim that she's one of those king's daughters. The Book of Tefi is a novel that was written in the late 19th century. It's a novel, not history at all. It's just a poem that somebody made up. That's all it is. And they tried to put it off as some Book of Tefi, like it's some ancient legend. And it's bullshit. The British Israel people in the late 18 and early 1900s, especially people like George Jowett, that they came up with so many fantastic stories that aren't true. And basically fabricated a lot of history, they didn't do us any favors. I know Christian identity is true, but the British Israel version of it is all pure freaking fantasy. It really is.
So I believe the Molossians are documented, right?
Yeah, I pronounce it Malaysians. It doesn't really matter. Not Malaysians in the South Pacific, but Malaysians, M-I-L-E-S-I-A-N-S. I mean, that's just how I've always pronounced it. For right or wrong, I don't care. I can spell it. They're from Miletus. They were Phoenicians from Miletus. And the Phoenicians at Miletus had become great mariners and explorers and founders of colonies. The Greek classics talk about this, how the Milesians or the Metamilitus had founded colonies on the Black Sea and sailed out beyond the gates of Hercules and all this. So they were Phoenicians by race. The famous philosopher Thales of Miletus is one of the seven sages of the ancient Greeks, is identified as a Phoenician by race by Herodotus. And they had been basically, well, it really wasn't that far different, but they had been basically assimilated into Greek culture at an early time. Well, the Milesians or Metamilitus, they settled in Spain, in Iberia, in Ireland, and perhaps points beyond that. But first, they were at their peak a couple of hundred years before the time of Ezekiel and Jeremiah. And second, that doesn't mean that the story with the king's daughters is true, the British Israel story. I would need more proof than that, or this one obscure passage in Ezekiel that I can see means something else.
So there was early settlers of Ireland were known as the Firbolgs, in that they actually went from Ireland up into what is now Scotland, and then some of them came back. But that's the way that the Scots got their name was said that was from Scota.
That's a legend. That's not really history. I don't accept that as history.
And then there was a whole thing with the Tuatha De Danann.
Now that I can see in history, and I do believe that that's probably a remnant or a portion of the tribe. Damn, I do believe that.
Yeah, because actually, Tuatha means tribe.
But that's a lot. That's a lot more credible than the fantastic story of Tia Tefi and Skoda, and this king's daughters who were unnamed in scripture.
It's interesting that so off the west coast of Ireland, those monks, they set up these like beehive fortresses, and there's one that's called Skellig Michael, and it's like this tower of rock that rises, I'm going to say, like 300 feet. Out of the ocean, it's probably about, I don't know, a quarter mile, half mile offshore, and that they had, and then perched on top of it, they had like this little community built out of rocks, right? They were hiding out from something. I mean, there's the whole aesthetic thing, but it went beyond that or something. I don't know.
Okay, I don't know. I really don't know how that's relevant here.
Yeah, but it was almost as if I don't know, like maybe
Hey Bill, where can we find the story of the daughters scripturally being fulfilled versus Tia Tefi?
You can't.
Okay, so is there a chance that's possibly could be fulfilled during the return under Ezra and Nehemiah?
Yeah, but was it a prophecy in the first place?
That's the point, that it's not really a prophecy of the king's daughters.
Okay.
Prophecy of the king's daughters. It never says that.
Well, Bill, you're absolutely right. You corrected me in my thinking on the seed. The seed is the boys, not the girls.
Yeah, the seed seed theoretically can include girls, but it's Jehoiachin's sons who were taken into captivity with him.
Okay, not Zedekiah's boys that got killed, and only the daughter survived. The way it's spun,
they were killed before his eyes.
Okay,
Jehoiachin was the legitimate king. I mean, Zedekiah was an uncle or something like that, I think.
Okay, because Bill, this is a big idol. I mean, this has been permeated for my studies for over 100 years that I know of.
Yeah, but it's I'm saying it's just bullshit. And the British Israel people, they kill me with these interpretations because there's no real material basis for them.
Okay, and Bill, one other question dovetailing to this. What about the little thing like Bob Holstrom? I got his little staple back on Ezekiel's riddle. I think it's Ezekiel 21. Is that another mistake, that trap they fall into?
I don't remember what it says. Maybe when we get there, a couple of weeks.
Okay, all right.
I really don't remember what Ezekiel 21 says.
That's cool. I see that Ezekiel 17 or Ezekiel 21, there's a riddle. And it might be Ezekiel 17.
It's Ezekiel 17.
Okay.
But it's clearly referring in verses 10, 11, 12, 13, it's clearly referring to the people that were taken captive, the 10,000 princes that were taken captive along with Jehoiachin when Zedekiah was installed as king. And that happened 6 years before this time that Ezekiel's writing this, 6.5 years. And that's what made the kingdom base. Because all the chief princes were taken out of Jerusalem, good men. Evidently, at least many of them were good men, and they were replaced with what? With the rabble. And Ezekiel had said in chapter 16 that thy land of nativity was of the land of Canaan, and thy mother was a Hittite, my father was an Amorite, or however it reads, that's basically what it says. One chapter before this. So that's how the kingdom became base, because all the good people were taken out. Zedekiah, who must have been some sort of Cretan, what was made king, and the kingdom became base because evidently all of this rabble filled the voids.
And base doesn't mean good. Base doesn't mean it was good.
Yeah, right. Not like they use it today.
Yeah, now that I read it in my New King James, it makes a lot more sense. It's in the context that makes more sense, Bill, than taking one passage, verse 21, I think, and it's completely out of its setting and throwing it way in the future.
I've seen it many times. I'll take like one verse and they'll make this whole extra biblical narrative based on one verse to make their little CI light doctrine work.
Yeah, right. Often. All the time. How about the as birds flying in Isaiah? It's clearly talking about the destruction of it's prophesying the destruction of the Assyrian army at the gates of Jerusalem, but they try to make it mean Allenby's conquest of Jerusalem in 1917, which is just straight bullshit.
It's a whole story. They wrote a big story and attached it onto a verse.
Attached
the whole book to one verse.
Yeah,
the whole narrative that isn't found in a prophecy at all.
Yeah, the other one is the Isaiah 18, where they put America in there. And that really stumbled me until, Bill corrected me on that about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there are places where America might belong. I believe it belongs in Micah chapter 4, but America is not alone in Micah chapter 4. And there are places, many places, where it doesn't belong.
Isaiah 18.
Probably, but maybe we'll find that out tonight.
Okay, moving right along.
Oh, Isaiah 18. No, probably not. No, America doesn't belong in Isaiah 18.
You getting comfortable in your little couch there, Martin?
Oh, yeah.
You ready to go?
His little couch.
What do you call them? Bean bags. He's got a bean bag, I'd say.
Ezekiel 18. The word of Yahweh came unto me again, saying, what mean ye, that ye use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. As I live, saith Yahweh, ye shall not have occasion any more to use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. As the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son is mine. The soul of that sinneth, it shall die. But if a man be just and do that which is lawful and right, and hath not eaten upon the mountains, neither hath lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, neither hath defiled his neighbor's wife, neither hath come near to a menstruous woman, and hath not oppressed any, but hath restored to the debtor his pledge, hath spoiled none by violence, hath given his bread to the hungry, and hath covered the naked with a garment. He that hath not given forth upon usury, neither hath taken any increase, that hath withdrawn his hand from iniquity, hath executed true judgment between man and man, hath walked in my statutes, and hath kept my judgments, to deal truly, he is just.
Disconnected from your channel.
Shall surely live, saith Yahweh. If he beget a son that is a robber, a shedder of blood, and that doeth the like to any one of these things, and that doeth not any of those duties, but even hath eaten upon the mountain and defiled his neighbor's wife, hath oppressed the poor and needy, hath spoiled by violence, hath not restored the pledge, and hath lifted up his eyes to the idols, hath committed abomination. End of verse 12.
Well, it's just addressing the people that are about to go into captivity, that they're going to be punished for their sins. And it outlines some of those sins that are an abomination. It indicates also what the people of Jerusalem had been doing at that time. The usurers, the people that get bribed in judgment, the people that oppress debtors and spoil them by violence or don't feed or take care for the hungry or the oppressed, those that defile their neighbor's wife or come near to a menstruous woman, because that's definitely against the law.
It's not
so. There are indications of what sins the people of Jerusalem were committing. I mean, there were probably worse things than those, but those things are bad enough.
And in ancient Israel, coming near a menstruous woman, that would have been like sleeping with her. That wasn't talking. Like in some cultures, a menstruous woman has to like leave the house and you don't see her for a week or whatever. That's yeah. Not the way ancient Israel was. It wasn't that. It was saying if you...
Right. That would be sleeping with her.
Okay.
In verse 8, it seems that we aren't even to borrowing. We know that it's against the law to exact usury, but...
Yeah, but the law, what the commandments of God are doing here are supporting the people that have gotten themselves into debt. That the people that are loaning the money are committing the greater sins. The people that are borrowing it, even though it's wrong, sometimes you have no choice, right? And if you can't borrow from a wealthy man any money without usury, what do you do?
Yeah, I know. It just seems that the beginning of 8 is telling us that we're actually giving power to the form of usury because we're contributing to it by borrowing, even though we are stuck.
If you're oppressed, you have no choice.
Yeah.
The children of Israel were told to basically loan their money without usury to their own brethren. Well, when the people that had the money won't do that, what are the people that don't have money and need it? what do they do?
Yeah, and we're in that situation, right?
We all are. And that's why it says he that has not given forth upon usury, meaning he that has not loaned money at usury.
See, I thought that the second part of that sentence, neither hath taken any increase, referred to those.
Taking increase means I give you $10 and you got to give me 12 back tomorrow.
Yeah, I know, but that's what I mean. But it sounds to me like the first sentence is actually talking about just participating.
No, it's a Hebrew parallelism.
Okay.
It's a parallelism. He has not given forth upon usury, neither has taken any increases. Basically, two ways of saying the same thing.
Okay, I feel better now. I really do. Because I was looking up the Strong's concordance here, and I see what you're saying now. I just thought it was what I was saying, which is that to add to it, like to make it possible by borrowing. But I see what you're saying. It's a parallelism. Okay.
But well, the borrower gives increase, he doesn't take it.
Well, yeah, I understand the second part of the sentence. I was just worried about the first part, right?
Okay. It's pretty plain to me. He that is not given forth upon usury. That word that's translated given forth means...
it means add, apply, appoint, ascribe, assign. I mean, there's a whole long list of them.
It just means to give, put, or set. I mean, yeah, there might be other meanings, but...
It's one of those words with many, many translations, but they're all pretty much the same thing.
Verse 13.
I don't know. Does anyone else have anything to say?
Yeah, it was kind of a clumsy place to start. I'm sorry. If he begets a son that is a robber, or if he's doing any of these other things, if he has oppressed the poor and needy, has spoiled by violence, and now in 13, if he has given forth upon usury, and yeah, okay, you could go with that.
Yeah, like it's, yeah. I mean, so what are you saying now? What do you think?
Well, no, this is just the saying the opposite, that the man who hasn't done any of these things has walked in my statutes and has kept my judgments to deal truly. He is just, he shall surely live. And that's the portion of the verse 9. But then if he does do any of these things, then it gives the punishment in verse 13. So Martin should have read one more verse, but I didn't notice it when he stopped, and I'm sure he didn't either.
Yeah, okay, so hath given forth upon usury is again lending.
Yeah, it's just repeating the same sentence. If you haven't done these things, that's good and you're going to live. If you have done these things, we're in the middle of that now. If you have done these things, then you're going to surely die. Martin.
Verse 13. Hath given forth upon usury and hath taken increase. So he then live. He shall not live. He hath done all these abominations. He shall surely die. His blood shall be upon him. Now lo, if he beget a son that seeth all his father's sins, which he hath done, and considereth and doeth not such like, that hath not eaten upon the mountains, neither hath lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, hath not defiled his neighbor's wife, neither hath oppressed any, hath not withholden the pledge, neither hath spoiled by violence, but hath given his bread to the hungry, and hath covered the naked with a garment, that hath taken off his hand from the poor, that hath not received usury nor increase, hath executed my judgment, judgments, hath walked my statutes, he shall not die. For the iniquity of his father, he shall surely live. As for his father, because he cruelly oppressed, spoiled his brother by violence, and did that which is not good among the people, lo, even he shall die in his iniquity. Yet say ye, why? Doth not the son bear the iniquity of the father? When the son hath done that which is lawful and right, and hath kept all my statutes, and hath done them, he shall surely live. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him. But if the wicked will turn from all his sins that he hath committed, and keep all my statutes, and do that which is lawful and right, he shall surely live. He shall not die. All his transgressions that he hath committed, they shall not be mentioned unto him. His righteousness that he hath done, he shall live. Have I any pleasure at all that the wicked should die, saith Yahweh, and not that he should return from his ways and live? But when the righteous turneth away from his righteousness, and committeth iniquity, and doeth according to all the abominations of the wicked man doeth, shall he live? All his righteousness that he hath done shall not be mentioned in his trespass that he hath trespassed, and in his sin that he hath sinned, in them shall he die. Yet ye say, the way of Yahweh is not equal. Hear now, O house of Israel, is not my way equal? Are not your ways unequal? When a righteous man turneth away from his righteousness, and committeth iniquity, and dieth in them for his iniquity that he hath done, shall he die. Again, when the wicked man turneth away from his wickedness that he hath committed, doeth that which is lawful and right, he shall save his soul alive, because he considereth and not turneth away from all his transgressions that he hath committed, he shall surely live, he shall not die. Yet says the house of Israel, the way of Yahweh is not equal. O house of Israel, are not my ways equal? Are not your ways unequal? Therefore I will judge you, O house of Israel, everyone according to his ways, saith Yahweh. Repent and turn yourselves from all your transgressions, so iniquity shall not be your ruin. Cast away from all your transgressions whereby ye have transgressed, and make you a new heart and a new spirit. For why will ye die, O house of Israel? For I have no pleasure in death of him that dieth, saith Yahweh. Wherever turn yourselves and live ye. Wherefore turn yourselves and live ye.
Yeah.
Hey, Martin.
Yep.
I got a comment on this passage. I'm going to bring up some old memories. This is a passage that Eli used to say that it's not a bastard's fault that he's a bastard. It was the sin of the father, and that God's not going to judge the bastard unequally. And this is a passage that Eli uses to say that it's not the bastard's fault that he's a bastard.
Yeah, because Eli wants to be a Talmudic Jew and try to pin God down to his own law when the law isn't even for bastards.
I agree, Bill, but my memory, I had to say that because my memory went way back.
Yeah.
He's a hypocrite. Eli wanted to,
no, that's right. Eli did use this passage, and I answered that at the time, but Eli won't listen to reason. He only cares about his own agenda. And it was only a couple of years later that I found that around the same time, Eli's daughter married a fucking sand nigger. And I think that's why that issue was forced to the surface, because Eli was trying to justify his daughter marrying a sand nigger. But it don't really matter in the end, because Eli's a Jew. So he's a bastard, and so's his daughter.
I agree. His son's family lineage comes from Egypt. Eli will tell you that.
Yeah, right. The land of bastards.
And didn't the other daughter marry a nigger as well, right?
Yeah, you know, she was dating a chink back in 2011. I even had his name and I had a video of him somewhere. I don't know if I still have it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like it caused Eli any real concern, because instead of actually putting away his daughter, he tried to rewrite the Bible.
Yeah, and he went to the wedding, right. He's no better than a Talmudic Jew.
So another thing about Eli was that Eli was in Elohim City with fucking Timothy McVeigh. And it turned out that Elohim City, that the CIA was using that to run drugs into the United States.
Okay. I would doubt it.
That doesn't mean Eli's a CIA agent, but...
Yeah, I wouldn't put that together.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Okay, Ezekiel chapter 18, right? At the beginning where it says, what mean ye that ye use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying the fathers have eaten a sour grape, and the children's teeth are set on edge. So the people were saying that. But the word of God doesn't say that. You see what I mean? He's saying, what do you mean that you use this proverb? In other words, why are you saying this? So they were using that proverb, evidently, but that doesn't mean the proverb was true, that they were using it. And we see that proverb in Jeremiah also, but that still doesn't mean that the proverb was true. And in Jeremiah, it's basically saying the other thing, the same thing, that this isn't going to happen, that every man will die for his own iniquity. So that being said, I mean, there were times in the Old Testament when children suffered for the sins of the fathers. One of those times was Achan in the Valley of Achor, that he took the silver and the gold and the Babylonian garment. So his children, his wives, his asses, his sheep, his pet hamster, his Pomeranian, they were all struck dead. They were all killed for that transgression. I'm kind of kidding about the Pomeranian. Sort of.
Yeah, we don't know that. Can't
wouldn't
prove
that
it,
also qualify as one of the times that the children was punished for the sins of the father was with David when he took the wife of Uriah? I know I messed that name up.
The first child died. I understand that.
Right.
The first child did die
for
that reason.
So that be the same?
That could be another example of that, but it's not a law. And it's not a law. When we read about the gainsaying of Korah in Numbers chapter 26, and we read from verse 10, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah, all the company of Korah that joined him. When that company died, what time the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a sign. Notwithstanding, the children of Korah died not. They didn't die. They weren't punished. So it's not a law.
Aren't we like suffering from the sins of our fathers today?
So yeah, I thought we're this not being was directly punished for them. We're just suffering from the consequences that can't be helped.
Like when they decided we want an earthly king. Aren't we suffering
right.
for their sin today, and right, I thought absolutely. This was a prophecy of the future, that in the future we would no longer have to suffer the sins of our fathers, but today we still do have to. I thought we still were, but I could be wrong.
This is saying that the sons are not going to be condemned under the law that their fathers are, that they're not going to suffer that judgment. That's all this is saying. This doesn't mean that you're not going to have to deal with the consequences of your father's sin. And it's possible that you won't. I mean, not everybody has.
You may have to deal with the consequences of the sin, of your father's sin, but you're not guilty of the sin.
Right. And you won't suffer the penalty of the law for that sin, is how I read this. You're not going to suffer the penalty of the law for your father's sin, is what this is saying. It's not right. saying that there won't be other consequences. Of course there will be. When you live in a sinful nation, there's always going to be other consequences.
Sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
I'm just saying you're not going to be punished under the law for those sins because you didn't commit them.
Would you divide it up into national sin and individual sin then too? Because like all Israel is still under a punishment of death.
Yeah, right. All Israel, all Judah, this is made to the people of Judah that are about to go into Babylonian captivity, and they're all going to go into captivity. So yeah, that's a consequence of national sin. But this is clearly talking about personal sin. So Yahweh's telling them they're going to be punished as individuals for their sin. Now there's a lamentation for the princes of Israel in chapter 19. Which I read is the remnant of Judah here, not all of Israel, just Judah that's still in Israel. Which is the context, I believe.
The princes of Israel are actually the princes of Judah, then.
Right, because that's all that's left of Israel in Israel.
Is Judah, yeah. You want to read that one, Mark? Chapter 19.
Chapter 19.
Don't fight with that beanbag chair.
Yeah. Ezekiel 19. Moreover, take thou up a lamentation for the princes of Israel, and say, what is thy mother? A lioness. She lay down among lions. She nourished her whelps among the young lions. And she brought up one of her whelps. It became a young lion, and it learned to catch the prey. It devoured men. The nations also heard of him. He was taken in their pit, and they brought him with chains unto the land of Egypt. And when she saw that she had waited, and her hope was lost, then she took another of her whelps, and made him a young lion. And he went up and down among the lions. He became a young lion and learned to catch the prey and devoured men. And he knew their desolate places, and he laid waste their cities. And the land was desolate, and the fullness thereof by the noise of his roaring. Then the nations set against him on every side from the provinces, and spread their net over him. He was taken in their pit. And they put him inward in chains. and brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into holds, that his voice should no more be heard upon the mountains of Israel. Thy mother is like a vine in thy blood, planted by the waters. She was fruitful and full of branches by reason of many waters. And she had strong rods for the scepters of them that bear rule. And her stature was exalted among the thick branches. And she appeared in her height with the multitude of her branches. But she was plucked up in fury. She was cast down to the ground. And the east wind dried up her fruit. Her strong rods were broken and withered. The fire consumed them. And now she is planted in the wilderness, in a dry and thirsty ground. And fire has gone out of a rod of her branches, which hath devoured her fruit, so that she hath no strong rod to be a scepter to rule. This is a lamentation, and shall be for a lamentation. End of chapter 19.
It sounds kind of like the parable of Christ, where he says, you know, plucked up and put in the furnace. Each branch which has no good fruit, it shall be, you know, cast into the fire.
But it almost sounds like Joseph, and then like the Babylon or the Assyrian captivities, the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. Being brought down to Egypt, and then.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the allusion to Joseph. I don't see how that could be in relation to the Babylonian and Assyrian captivities, because Ephraim went into Assyrian captivity, and so did Manasseh, the son of Joseph, right? They didn't really go to Egypt. I would really have to sit and contemplate this passage for a while.
Could this also be a prophecy of the fall of Babylon? Because in Micah, Israel is also compared to a lion. In Micah 5, which is sort of like a Hebrew parallelism for Micah 4. And in Micah 4, it says, you will be delivered unto Babylon. So here we see, and then the nations set against him on every side, which is like all the alien nations pouring into the holy mountain. And then we see that the lion attacks them, right? And then in Micah, the lion attacks these alien nations in Micah 5, and he tears them apart.
They were told over and over again not to look to Egypt for deliverance, but I don't know which of the kings turned to Egypt that could be described as having gone to Egypt. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
Josiah actually died at the hands of the Egyptians in 608 BC, perhaps. I believe that's 608 BC. And I don't know if any of the other kings actually turned to the Egyptians. One of them did. One of them actually did. And I'm thinking maybe it's referring to him. Didn't Zedekiah, one of those kings, appeal to Egypt? I believe. For help against the Babylonians.
Yeah. Jeremiah, remember where?
I'm not sure which it is, and I think that if that key is figured out that perhaps we could interpret this prophecy. But I can't find it. Or maybe I'm just kidding myself.
I view it as
it's the king sent men to Egypt, and they fetched Uriah out of Egypt. That was the prophet that fled to Egypt. And he was killed.
Well, in Jeremiah 42:14.
Okay.
Read that.
I'm all ears. So you want me to find it myself? And
yeah, it'd probably be better. I just view this as all about Israel in general, right?
Yeah, this is a warning not to go to Egypt. I thought I remembered one of the kings in this period actually trying to appeal to Egypt for help. Maybe I'm wrong, but they are being warned not to do it. So it seems that they must have wanted to.
Yeah, one of the kings did. I can't find it right now. I know he did. And he was being criticized for it, and I thought it was in Jeremiah.
Yeah, I can't find it.
Okay, let me try something.
Maybe it's towards the end of Ezekiel. That's what I'm trying to look for now. And there's a lot of warnings about Egypt, but I don't see anything explicit. No, I don't have anything explicit.
Well, man, I'm going to call tonight.
Okay, James. Yahweh bless. Good night, man. Good to see you.
Yahweh bless. Glad I got to hang out with y'all for a minute. My nights just ain't as long as they used to be.
You're getting old.
Damn it, I work a real job. I have to get up in the morning. Yahweh bless. Y'all have a good evening.
Thanks. Yahweh good bless.
So Jehoiakim
User went, disconnected from your channel.
Jeremiah, you said 42, didn't you? That's Jeremiah, the verse.
26:21 is talking about when Jehoiakim fled to Egypt.
Didn't you say Jeremiah chapter 42 or chapter 43, you must not go to Egypt, but Baruch, son of Neriah, you know, isn't that when that happened?
Well, yeah, there was that part too, when all the people wanted to go there, but that was after the Babylonians took over.
Jeremiah 42:19, the Lord has told you who are left in Judah not to go to Egypt. That's 42, Jeremiah 42. Is that the one you're looking for?
I think it's 26:21 when Jehoiakim goes there, but there's
no, that's not Jehoiakim going to Egypt. That's Jehoiakim going to find this prophet that fled to Egypt and kill him.
Oh, right. Okay. But I know what you're talking about, Bill. There is a there is warnings not to
go there's to warnings Egypt. Not to go to Egypt, but I can't remember if that the specific or if it's recorded that a specific sought to do that. They were just warned not to do it. But I don't know of any king that fled to Egypt.
Well, Rehoboam did. I believe it was him, right? But that was a lot earlier.
User disconnected from your channel.
Yeah, that's very much earlier.
Yeah, that's right after Solomon. But I don't know. I don't know what keyword to search for. Find it.
In Jeremiah 42, he's warning not to go. Then spake Azariah, the son of Hoshea, and the proud men saying unto Jeremiah, thou speakest falsely. The Lord our God hath not sent thee to say, go not into Egypt to sojourn there. But Baruch, the son of Neriah, setteth thee on against us. So they go. So basically in Jeremiah 43, they're basically doing it. They're basically like, nah, see you, Jeremiah, we're doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you are at a period after the destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah, that was after Babylon took over.
Okay, I thought you were looking. Okay, fair enough.
So that's out of context.
But I guess what we're trying to get to is the meaning of Ezekiel 19, right? Like the entire chapter. I just view it, I mean, it's a lamentation of the princes of Israel. The mother is Israel. And then
one of her whelps would have been one captivity. So she sends one of her whelps and it gets lost. And her hope was lost. Then she took another of her whelps and made him a young lion, and he went down. So it seems to me like these whelps that she's raising, and the lioness must be the holy city, and she's raising these whelps, and one of them's taken to Egypt, and one of them's taken to Babylon.
Yeah. So
and the other nations are like angry with Jerusalem.
Yeah, so when
proud Jerusalem, the holy city, and she's punished, I guess.
Okay, perhaps Egypt here is being used as a symbol of captivity, and it really means Assyria. And that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, Egypt sometimes means like the house of bondage. Yes. So like the nations heard of him and he was taken in their pit and taken to the land of bondage sort of
thing. In chains. And that must be a reference to the Assyrian captivities. And that so whelp she is sees Israel and the other whelp is Judah. And Judah besieged by the Babylonians. That's what this is taking. That's where we're at here. In my opinion. That Egypt is only a symbol of Keti. And it is often elsewhere also.
Yeah, that would make sense. Because that's the original captivity, so it's used as a...
as a metaphor for captivity. Right. So Israel's in captivity. That's the first whelp, and Israel is... in Assyrian captivity, but that's Egypt, allegorically. That's the only way I can make sense of this. Y'all don't have to talk at once.
Yeah, no, I hear you, Bill. I was just reading a bit. Well, I think we're all reading little bits of it. I was just getting down to verse 10, I think it is. Thy mother is like a vine in thy blood. So she's in thy blood. I don't know what that means.
Has I guess because... menstrual cycle.
Well, what does it mean if it's a city that's in the... I thought it meant it was like a bloody city that had committed all these crimes. But maybe it means something like the city is in thy blood. Maybe she's just given birth.
Maybe the mother is guilty of the children's blood.
Okay.
Yeah, let's see how it is in the Septuagint.
Sorry, Bill.
My mother was like a vine in thy blood, planted by the water. Her fruit and her branches have grown out of many waters. That's the Douay Rheims. Why don't I have a...
Brenton has, thy mother was as a vine and as a blossom on a pomegranate tree. But it seems like they want it to be like Zedekiah was a bloody king or something. Their commentaries, I don't know. That's how they seem to think of it.
The Greek, I don't have Brenton's translation here for some strange reason. Choose display versions. I lost one of my windows. Just not doing very good. Where is Brenton? Oh, Alex. Hey. Okay, I got Brenton back. Thy mother was like a vine. Now, I had already read that part in Greek, and that's true. It's a blossom, a flower in a pomegranate. Planted by the water. Her fruit and her blastos, or shoot, or branch, became much water. Wow. Where Brenton has abounded by reason of much water. Which is fine. Not really, but it's fine. It's poetic, but it's fine. Mother, like a vine, in blood, on water. That reference to blood, it's Dom, it's blood, it's no doubt, but it's kind of strange.
I'm seeing a lot of different thoughts on it, like in thy blood, either when you were first born or the royal line, thy kingly race, in thy blood. So there's a lot of, it's referring to the kingly race, or it's referring to because Israel was fruitful when it was first established.
That's still kind of weird to me. That idiom is weird to me. And I've actually studied all the words, all the occurrences of blood in the King James Version on several occasions. And that particular idiom just doesn't strike me as being familiar. It really doesn't.
The NKJV has, your mother was like a vine in your bloodline. Planted by the waters, fruitful and full of branches. So, your bloodline.
I don't buy that. I'm sorry. You're part of your mother's bloodline.
That's like Rotherham. Thy mother was like a vine of thy vineyard. So he doesn't even translate blood. He just makes it of thy vineyard.
Yeah, he's trying to read it metaphorically, but the word is definitely blood. In Hebrew. But we don't even see blood in the Greek, in the Septuagint.
It's one of those Bible mysteries where we can't really see what the ancients would have meant at this time. We need more information.
Okay, Dead Sea Scrolls. If the passage is in here. Because, you know, it's rarely in here. This is Ezekiel 19:10.
Yep.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I don't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. I usually read from Esau and then only open Bible Works when I need it.
Yeah, I'm usually in Bible. I have the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible in there. Okay, Ezekiel 38. Now, there ain't a whole hell of a lot of Ezekiel in Dead Sea Scrolls. It jumps from 16, from a little portion of 16 to a little portion of 23. And there's no chapter 19. Sorry. Dead Sea Scrolls Bible.
Oh, well, it's missing it. Yeah, it's missing a lot of stuff.
Okay, I think I found it. Isaiah 30, 2 to 4. That walk to go down into Egypt and have not asked at my mouth to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh and trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust in the shadow of Egypt be your confusion. That was the part where we're trying to find where that was mentioned. I think it's Isaiah 30, 2 to 3. And then in 31:1, it's woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and stay on horses and trust in chariots, because they are many and in horses, because they are very strong, but they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek Yahweh. And it goes on 31:3 as well.
I don't know if that's how I would interpret this here.
But there was a king, was king at that time, right? That was trusting in Egypt.
Yeah, but Isaiah is long before this.
Oh, this is not a prophecy. Okay, so this is that. Okay, so that was current to Isaiah's time.
What we have here in Ezekiel is writing these words over 100 years after Isaiah's time.
Yeah, but when I thought that he was prophesying it. Okay. Go to Syria then.
Oh, I think he's talking about Israel in general, but not about anything specific that any king of Israel did. No.
Okay.
I mean, this would have to be either interpreted to mean Israel and Judah, the two whelps, or two particular kings of Ezekiel's time to be a prophecy. That's how I see it. And because of the context, I lean towards it, interpreting this as Israel and Judah, and Egypt simply means captivity, allegorically speaking.
Yeah, for sure. Well, sure, but it makes sense to me.
The nations also heard of him, meaning Israel. He was taken in their pit, and they brought him with chains unto the land of Egypt, under the land of captivity.
Yeah, because Egypt is used elsewhere as captivity.
Yes. Yes, it is. And I think that's enough for this week.
So Ezekiel 20, starting next week.